If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Well, everybody, this is another edition of the Chicago Way, Radio Free Chicago in podcast form with Jeff Carlid and me, Casso, your favorite scribe. Jeff, what is going on with Hillary Clinton? The Congress comes out with the new Benghazi report. The Democrats screwed up and they redacted stuff, but it wasn't really redacted. So we found out that Sidney Blumenthal was making $200,000 a year hanging around with Hillary. And then she says, I have to earn your trust. Okay, question for Jeff Carlin. She's been in politics for 40 years. Everybody knows her. If she has to earn our trust now, what does that say about her?
It means that before she wasn't earning our trust. She was just earning our dollars and our votes.
What is that about?
I'm amazed. I mean, I'm amazed at this whole thing. I was thinking the whole time, I'm like, oh, the email server, that's going to bring her, that's going to knock her down a notch or two. This might be even bigger. I mean, this just because... Right now, she's got a lot of momentum going against Trump. I mean,
she's got all the reporters, most of American journalists, against Trump.
Right.
And they got all ginned up when Brexit happened in England, because all the English did, actually, was vote to be independent and run their own country. And American journalists are treating it as if it was, wow.
And Kristen McQuarrie.
Kristen McQuarrie, I'm talking about Hillary and Brexit. And there you come in. Hello, Kristen.
My timing is just phenomenal.
It's like Debbie Reynolds coming down the circular stairs half an hour after the party's begun. Hello.
Oh,
how are you?
I don't know if
I'll
go that far. I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
Oh, my God. John Cassidy's got a ring. He just waved his hand at us. He's got his wedding ring.
I have to see it up close. Hold on.
There you go.
It's amazing, John. Outstanding.
How long has it been on your finger? And, like, did you get it blessed or anything?
I actually didn't even have a chance to get it blessed yet. I put it on my right hand because Orthodox... Put it on the right, even though now that we're in America, wear it on your left so that people know you're married. What is it on? I put it on my right hand first, and it wouldn't come off.
Oh, no.
But he's like, oh, my God. So we got some
butter.
Some Windex.
Soap. Yeah, some Windex. And, yeah, I put it on
Windex
my left hand. And,
oh,
I just
that's
thought
great.
I'd show
it
you.
Looks phenomenal.
The wedding ring that was cut off years ago and lost. And
yes.
Yeah.
And Betty wanted you to have a ring. So
yeah,
you
so she got me the ring for my birthday. That
it looks
nice.
Really nice. Something is different when a man is wearing a wedding band, I must say.
Yes, it looks like we're more stable.
Civilized.
We're more content.
Yes.
And we're more easily, pulled from one, right?
Yes.
We're
well,
not
we
like
just
as wild.
More subdued or
right?
something. Mature? I don't know.
Mature, that sounds good.
Well, one man who I don't know where's one or not is Bill Clinton, but his wife is having some issues with what happened with Operation Push. Did you hear about this?
She had a fundraiser, right? But I didn't get...
She shows up at Operation Push, and Tribune has this story that the Push has a brain freeze because a worker for Push just basically went on the internet, pasted her biography into Push program, like, welcome, Hillary, you're wonderful, and which that said, she is the first lady, she is the only first lady to have been subpoenaed.
Oh,
this was
no.
in the Push, like, welcome to the luncheon for women.
Oh, I bet they went to Wikipedia and just
and her marriage endured the Lewinsky scandal of 1998.
That is great.
Isn't that good?
I
that
love
you put
that.
In there, you know,
that's, you know, it's your bio.
Yeah, that's
sure
the
you
bio,
have a bio, but
women
you
with hats at a lunch.
Oh,
you know,
that is
doing
wonderful.
That whole thing.
Wow,
that is like right. That is so embarrassing, isn't
Oops.
It?
Yeah, oops to whoever did that, because how many bios are there of Hillary Clinton? Plenty that are glowing. So to hang her dirty laundry out there at a welcoming.
But the fact that nobody noticed it except for the guy from Alder Trek, I think, Mike Frechet.
Oh, sure.
And then he tweeted it out. And now she's got the Benghazi report comes out. I know we want to talk about how terrible conservatives are who might want to live in a country that they actually control. In other words, you might want to have a country with your own borders, like England.
But I know there are a bunch of,
David Axelrod tweets out immediately after that. About Brexit, says 66% of the people who voted didn't.
Oh,
in other words,
on.
But this is a Democrat saying that they're stupid for voting for their independence.
Sure. Well, we hear that a lot about Trump voters here, and I just have to constantly remind people, you know, you live in this little what you think is a progressive Democratic bubble called Chicago. Get out of the city once in a while and meet the rest of the United States of America, and then you will not be so surprised at the outrage, at the pushback. And by the way, the Brexit vote turnout was something like 72%.
Right.
So you're telling me 70, you know, people were motivated to go to the polls, and you claim they weren't aware.
They're stupid.
That's
stupid,
exactly
or
what
they're racist or whatever. And really, we wouldn't even be calling them that, even though they're not. We wouldn't even be calling them that if it didn't have an impact on the Hillary Clinton rate, which is why we, as journalists, not me or you or Jeff, but I think in the main, journalism savages Brexit voters because it threatens Hillary. That's what it's about. Isn't it?
Well, it's also about what you tweeted, that you have the media all weighing in on this, and the media is part of the elite.
Yes.
So they're just, they didn't know what they were doing, and we need to have a second referendum vote because they couldn't possibly have understood
the best and the brightest.
What it meant. I mean, that is the core of superior mentality and elitism.
Well, what would you get in an institution where... I think in the main, you didn't go to Ivy League schools, did you?
Well, do you consider Illinois State University?
Right.
Public school, educated,
kindergarten through graduate school.
And I've attended various colleges.
you hang out with your sons.
I attended a college.
You're paying for colleges.
I'm paying for two now. But you know what I mean? I'm not from that thing. Neither is Kristen. It's odd that people are not, if you're not part of that thing, that elite, generally, you're going to have a hard time getting, what are you going to reflect back on this thing that you know better.
And that's what, even the whole GOP movement and the idea that somehow they could still change the rules to take the nomination away from Trump, from the beginning, I've just thought it's just such an elitist standpoint to try to do what you think is best and erase the motivation and votes of all of those people who stood in line and knew exactly what they were getting when they voted for Donald Trump.
If you want to be a pro-Hillary meat puppet, be my guest. I love you anyway. But admit what you're doing, to yourself at least. Mm-hmm. To yourself, admit it. Admit what you're doing. Because this woman has problems with the truth. 40 years, now the headline in the Tribune, she's going to earn our trust.
At this point, what difference does it make, John?
At this point, what difference does it make?
Poor dead American. What difference does it make?
At first I was dismayed. I was horrified. I should have won 2008 by a landslide. But then I spent so many nights thinking how Obama did me wrong, and I grew strong. And I wrote this comeback song, and now I'm back. Gonna own the place. Oval is mine now. I've started measuring those damn drapes. Gotta change that front door lock. Secret Service, take away your key. Gonna break through that glass ceiling. Gonna make some history. Go on now, go! Walk out the door. Might as well resign now, 'cause they don't want you anymore. They gotta vote for me, though I haven't told them why. But you know I ain't humble. I ain't beyond a lie. No, no, not I. I will survive as long as I know how to lie. I know I'll stay alive. Not much time for me to live, so I got one last shot to give, and I'll survive. I will survive.
And now on the Chicago Way, which is, as you know, Radio Free Chicago, behind the corruption curtain, Jeff Carlin. And I have a special guest, and we're going to start doing this more often, but I wanted this guy to be the kickoff guest on the show where we'll talk politics to a real political person, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, son of the South Side. Good. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Great. Thanks for having me on, John.
Thanks for coming.
Southsider, Southsider.
There you go. And Palatine. The Palatine Celtics.
Guilty.
Guilty.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to confess, so you guys know, listening, I met Tom. I've known Tom for quite some time, but we got back together a couple weeks ago. I had a lunch with him, and I told him something that I should tell the listeners, which was I got really pissed off at Tom. And this was a few years ago when he was talked about possibly running for mayor of Chicago, and then he didn't. And then I was like, gosh, what's wrong with you? So why don't we start there? I want to apologize for being upset, but I was.
No, nothing to apologize about, John. You know, I try to explain to people that though some people in the political world sort of push this to the limit, we're human too. And so with me, it was a very strange thing because I enjoy government. I enjoy what I do right now, but I've enjoyed, you know, being involved with government and making a difference in people's lives. And so when the mayor's Mayor Daley said he wasn't running again, took me and I believe most of the world by surprise. And my initial reaction is, well, that's an office where I think I can do some good things. And I knew that if I was going to do it, had to move quick. So I started putting some things together. But then as I started doing it, it became abundantly clear that my family was going to suffer beyond norm because I have a large family. I've got 5 kids. They're all a year apart, 6, 8, 10, 12, and 14.
Irish twins, sounds like.
Yeah, and back then it was 1, 3, 5, 7, 9,
right.
I think, whatever. And so it was abundantly clear with just the initial part of it when I was trying to put a campaign together that it was really tearing apart the thing, frankly, that I value more than anything else, which is my family. And I could be more sincere with you in saying that if I stopped in politics tomorrow, I wouldn't shed a tear. I'd be upset that I think I can still do some good things to help people. But if I ever felt that I was being a bad dad, I couldn't live with myself, especially someone, frankly, who sits around and talks about all these dysfunctional people that I see in and out of my jail and all these people that walk away from their kids and the rest of it. And then me, because I'm in politics, I get to walk away from my family and I can come up with some twisted, contorted logic to sit there and say, oh, but this is better for our family. What's better? You're no longer around. We don't see you. We don't hear from you. You're not there. And so for me, it was just a really bad time for me to do it. And it took me not too long, but it took me a while to see what was right in front of me, that this was going to destroy the thing I value most.
The kid. So you should know something about Tom Dart. He doesn't have a law practice. He's not running a real estate tycoon business on the side. He's not a mega super sports agent or agent of stars. Actually, you don't really have a side business.
No, I never did. When I was in the legislature, you get a kick out of this, John, because my dad was in government. He worked for old Mayor Daley and worked for Mike Hollett. And my dad did truly everything in his power to keep me out of government. He kept saying, Tom, you're too nice. You're too smart. Go make money. And my dad had nothing. His father died when he was 5, so he worked every day of his life and didn't want us to go through it. And I said, Dad, this is what I really want to do. And he wanted me to stay out of it. And so he would have friends of his that would, when I was down in the legislature, they would take runs at me to try to get me to change because I was one of 2 lawyers down there who did not practice law, that my entire salary was the $30-some thousand of the legislator. And I told people, I'm happy with that. I'm a single guy. I live with my dog. I don't need a lot of money. This allows me to really throw myself into my job. And I don't feel any of this weird tugging that, you got a client here, you got this interest, that interest. It was just solely focused on
it.
But
it's the same way now. You don't have that.
No,
you're a guy in politics who works for, you're a public official with just a salary.
And I like it that way. And John, some of it's just the personal side of things. I often tell people, if it wasn't for the fact that I love kids and I like women, I probably would have been a priest because I love working with people. I love trying to do things to help bigger communities. And so for me, money has never motivated me. Honest to God, the amount of grief I get from my brothers, my friends about some of the outfits I wear. And it's not that they're outfits, but it's just like, hey, it's fine. It's a little frayed at the end, but who cares?
Theater of the mind, Tom Dart. I'm out the Page 2 columnist. I've got jeans on and a shirt that I'm not tucking in because you know how skinny I am, everybody. And Tom Dart comes up with a U.S. Open shirt, sweater, a jersey on, khakis, and he's got a button-down collar. We both have Southwest Side button-down collar boys. But you're not into the big suits and the look either.
No. You know what? You'll get a kick out of this one. I was looking to run for mayor, so everyone came to me and said, you can't keep going with this look. Of
Mount Carmel, pretty middle-aged Mount Carmel guy.
Yeah, exactly. So they say you can't do it. You gotta get some suits. So I went to a place and got some suits. Well, I've since, I mean, trust me, not that I've gone on a crash diet, but I just make sure that I watch what I eat and stuff like that. So I've lost, I don't know, 15 pounds. None of my suits fit. So the only suits I have, if you ever see me without a coat on, they're all bunched up in the back. My brother's like, you can't wear that. You cannot go out like that. I was like, who am I trying to impress here? I mean, come on. I work in a jail. Am I trying to impress the detainees? Come on, give me a break.
Now we're in the new season. The mayor of Chicago is considered weakened. He's had some problems. Are you considering it again?
You know, my children have gotten older, so it's not as obvious an issue as it was before. But the two things, John, seriously, is one, I really, really love what I'm doing right now. I really do. And I'm very aware of, like, all the frustrations.
Yeah, but he might not run again.
Yeah, but he's not the issue. To be honest with you, whether he ran or not, if I'm ready to go, I'm going. If he's in office, I don't really care. I mean, it would be because I feel that I can really make a difference and I'm willing to put everything into it and set aside some things with my family maybe. So I haven't had to make that decision yet, I guess. And I guess part of it is not that I'm trying to put off a decision, but I'm open more than I would have been 2 years ago, for sure. But have I completely said, listen, this is right for me and my family? I haven't. But I also think that a year from now, I will have a better handle on where my kids are at.
But you're open to the idea of at least considering it now.
This time I am. Before, I would have told you categorically my kids are still way too young. They're young, but, there's sacrifices we all make in life. And so I'm willing to look at some of those.
What are the problems facing Chicago?
Well, you know, the one that I think is so overwhelming that I would be lying to you if I said that I have both the grasp of all the dynamics and certainly the answer is the finances. I mean, the finances, I don't want to say everything starts and stops there, but I'll be frank with you. I mean, I've read so much, and I do it in my job, too, about crime-related issues. And, you need police on the street. I mean, but if you have no money, you can't hire them. But yet, I understand that part of it. So the finances lead to so many other things, because if you don't have the money, you start just dealing with overtime issues more and using overtime as opposed to hiring people. And I just finished reading a study just last night, actually, and it was a commission done by the president's office, but it brought in a bunch of experts to look at crime issues in general. And one of the things I found startling that I didn't really completely appreciate is that studies have been done showing that when you kick up the number of police on the street, there is a certain defined decrease in crime. That it's not just this really sort of obtuse type of thing. Well, yeah, they've actually studied and showing that, and the case they were making, and they have numbers supporting it, is that you actually get more bang for your buck by putting more police on the street than if you raise penalties. That the deterrent effect of additional penalties they've shown with recidivism rates is not as great as if you put more police on the street. And it's not just something where you put more police on the street and you've pushed the crime to another neighborhood. The crime just doesn't occur. And we've seen that, too, because our sheriff's department, we do a lot more work in the city now than we've ever done. And we've told people before that we're not magic. We're not like we know what, we're good at what we do. But what we're doing is we're adding more bodies. And when you put more bodies on a street, there's less crime. I mean, will the gangbangers move a couple blocks? Maybe a couple blocks. Are they going to move 4 miles away? Nope, they're not.
So why isn't Chicago doing it?
I would imagine a lot of it's driven by the money, and that the finances are such a mess that it prevents them from taking on issues like more police. Because, once again, I'd be lying to you if I said I have the book in front of me and this is what their manpower is.
You don't have the magic wand.
No, right? I don't.
Who does? Right?
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, though, John.
But priorities are important. And it seems to me, just seems common sense. You have more cops on the street, you hire more cops, you need them.
Yeah, yeah. And see, I've seen this all around the county because of issues, particularly, the papers have been making a lot of note of it as well. Because of the financial issues, not just in Chicago, but in the surrounding towns and villages around the county, they're somewhat masked because so much of focus is put on Chicago. But I see so many of these towns and villages, and their finances are complete train wrecks. And you look at every one of these towns, it's the same formula. The biggest expense they have are their police and fire. So what do? As opposed to layoffs, which get people very upset and makes headlines, they just don't fill positions. So attrition occurs, and their headcount drops. And what do you see then? You see crimes increasing. You see us having to go into more towns and villages than we've ever had to do. And so it's, I don't want to say it's a simple formula, John, but you're pretty close to it. The more bodies, physical police you put out there, everything shows that that works. And it's also a way to reconnect with communities as well and build trust with people because you have police there and you can talk to people more instead of just racing from one call to another to another.
And Sheriff Dart, you being within the Cook County jails here, you see a lot of the prison population is affiliated with gangs, and I know you guys do a lot to track, mark tattoos, and keep a book on that kind of thing. But I know one of the things that kind of helped some of the violence problems that Chicago faced in like the 90s was this coalescing of gang leaders and saying, hey, you know, you guys got to get this stuff under control. This is you can't run a city like this. People are dying. Kids are dying. Is there any thought of any sort of ability to do that moving forward? Anyway, I know that they're so fractured, but it feels like, and everyone I talk to who's on the street say that, oh, it's these kids, it's not the old school guys, it's these kids running around shooting each other.
I think, you know what, it could never, I couldn't see any scenario where that could ever occur again, because the dynamics have changed so dramatically now, where, as you just mentioned, the kids, these kids are all carrying guns. They're factions. And we see it play out, as you mentioned, in the jail all the time, where even like a faction, a small breakoff faction that's on the street, when it hits the jail, they factionalize even further. And so just keeping track of that's very difficult for us, but we do, but it's very difficult. But the point being is that I can conceive of no scenario where all of a sudden there'd be one, two, three, four people that would come together and say, listen, this is in our best interest to do it this way. Because these folks are not thinking logically. They aren't thinking in these grand schemes of this will help our dope business better. This will help us be able to make more profit by the police won't bother us as much because there's no less violence here. They're not thinking like that. These are reactionary kids who are being set off by what happened on Facebook and what someone said on some social media about them. And the violence is so intense that I don't think could occur even if people agreed that was good. And there's a lot of people go back and forth on that. I can conceive of no scenario where someone would be able to do it other than, frankly, this horrific bloodbath where literally some guy went in there and he started shooting all these different people and scared everyone to death where they said, okay, we'll coalesce around this guy. So, I mean, I think...
Like Genghis Khan coalescing the tribes?
Yeah. I mean, it's just in such a way right now that I couldn't conceive of that ever. Because I think most everyone will see the actions of these folks on the streets are so horribly unpredictable. They're not based on logic. Mm-hmm. They're not based on, okay, this is going to help my business, my selling of this. Uh-uh. This is all personal. This is about getting back this guy that said this about me, this person who did this to someone from my gang. And so the ability to deal with it is so difficult. I feel so bad for so many of the Chicago coppers that are out there right now, because what they're dealing with has never been like this before. And there's good people working on it. You know, there's a lot of folks from like the sort of academic side of it that are trying different things. But I know I've worked with a couple different folks from the University of Chicago just on the gun side of it. And the more I work with them, these people are so not just smart, but they get it, you know, and their logic there. When you read some of the stuff, you're just like, wow, this is even more difficult than I thought. Because I'll tell you, like, we're working on some of the gun stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I've tried to explain to people over and over again, I mean, how many more times do we want to waste time and energy saying, let's go pass a bill? Good luck passing a bill. Why constantly focus on that? Let's deal with what we have. Let's work with the issues and the people we have and the tools that we have right now. Well, in dealing with that, you sit there, okay, what would be the best way to get the most amount of guns off the street? When I talk to these UFC guys, the thing that's so distressing about it is that this notion that I'm not saying my notion was this naive, but this notion that if you get these one or two guys that are moving guns, we can really take a dent out of this, it's not like that. Everything that has come through shows that the gun market is so loosey-goosey that it's somebody's cousin who knew somebody who was able to get his girlfriend to go to Indiana, and she was able to get two guns. Or this guy here, his brother knows somebody who was able to get one gun. And then also the logic behind it too, John, was just astounding to me, because I never really thought like this. These guys, because a lot of these are all interviews that are done in the jail with guys who are brought in on gun cases. And there's a part of it that the logic is incredible. They want to move their guns quick. Why? Because they're sitting there saying, okay, I got this gun from my girlfriend's brother's cousin. No one knew where this gun came from. This gun could have been used in a triple homicide. I don't want to be the guy caught with it because it'll come back that I did it then. So after I use my gun, I'm ditching it. I'm either selling it or I'm getting hiding it, dumping it, whatever it is. So there's this fluidity there too. So it just makes it so that the gang problem, the gun problems are really, really complicated.
One way to uncomplicate it from my point of view, and I don't know if I'm on the same page here, there's no incentive not to have a gun. If you're a gangbanger, you're a kid, it's probably stupid not to have one. You think of the logic of things because
that's what they say too.
People are walking around and they're going to try to kill you. And you're so why not make it hurtful to carry one? The mandatory minimum. I think the mandatory minimum for gun crime should be 5 years at basic, and make it tough. But then where do you stand on that?
I'm okay with that. If and this isn't like if, you know, monkeys fly, you know, I'm okay with this if it's part of this broader type of change. Because the thing I've been focusing so much time and energy on in the jail is these folks that are brought in for really no reason. And now, am I saying that people are like going through the phone book and picking names? No, I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that you and I and the rest of the world sit there and say, based on that, we're spending $150 a day to lock this guy up. That makes no sense. So my plan has been, and we've been somewhat successful, is put a lot of time and energy into getting those folks out of the jail and doing
that. You're talking about nonviolent drug offenders, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I can go with that.
And nonviolent property offenders. If we put that together as a package, then a lot of the people pushing back on the mandatory minimums, I think, would buy into it. Because I think you're right. Unless we send that message that, you know, you get caught with a gun, it's real serious and you're going to be gone for a while, we're kidding ourselves. But if we do it in isolation, then a lot of people are saying this is just another way everyone's going to lock up all the poor people. And this is if it's done as a way saying, listen, here's what we're doing.
Be another Clinton crime bill.
Yeah.
Just throwing that out.
I know. Well, that's what I mean. The problem is it's got to be part of this more thoughtful thing that's doable. Because usually if you make something really big, it'll never happen. But we've shown in Springfield the last 2 years, we've gotten some things done on retail theft, on traffic cases.
Trade. I don't want your three rock cases.
Yes.
And you give me the kid with the gun, 5 years mandatory
bingo.
Minimum.
Bingo.
Can we make a deal?
Bingo.
All right, it's done.
All right, it's solved.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, start getting these kids.
Put a bow on it.
I still think that in the long term, Tom Dart is going to be considered as a mayoral candidate because this is weird, because I don't generally like politicians, everyone.
that makes two of us.
You're not held, when you mention your name, when I mention your name, it's not like, oh, that, you're not thought of as like some, you're not thought of as some guy from, there's not that animosity to, why is that?
You know, I've had some other people in the political world that come up to me and they'll say, how do you get all this good media? You know, who's your press guy? And I always tell them, like, oh, it's not because of press people. We have some good people that work with me. Don't get me wrong. We have some really good people. But I always tell people, I go, just be straight with people. The folks, they aren't expecting you to be a miracle worker. They just expect you to be honest. And so.
But I'm not talking about your PR thing, because after a while, I was overdosing on Tom Dart stories. It was kind of too nice. But I mean, just generally the.
Well, I think it comes from the fact that if you try just to be straight with people, folks figure that out, that you're not polling. You're not sitting there saying, okay, I'm going to do this because this is going to help this agenda of mine or that agenda of mine. When you're just being straight and thoughtful, I think people pick up on that you're not full of it and you're not aiming for something else and there's this other hidden agenda. I think people they underestimate the voters. They're a lot smarter than people credit for, and they can pick up when people are just constantly filling them full of you-know-what.
Speaking of which, how do you think of Chicago View?
I think there's a lot of people that are less than they don't buy into it because they figure that when some of this stuff is being done, is it because of a different agenda? Because in part of it's created by himself, because he's always made it a point of letting people know that, you know, he's master of the agenda and he's, you know, win the media for the day and things like that. And then people then sit there and say, well, is this one of those days where we're just trying to win the media, or is this a very thoughtful thing to believe in that's actually going to advance this? And so I think then people get a little bit jaded and they sit there and say, they believe it. And so I think that bites the mayor sometimes, because people will sit there and say, well, you know, is this really what he feels, or is this advancing going to help this other issue? And then it gets a little bit hard.
people should know, if you have a good relationship with him, talk, does he call you up and say, let's hang out, let's go to, I'll meet you at Wojo's at, you know, on Pulaski at 99th Street?
No.
No?
I don't think we haven't spoken, I don't think, 5 or 6 years.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know why, but I mean, I am. He's busy, I'm busy, but,
yeah,
you know.
You got a jail to run.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, but I talk to other mayors, you know, in the county. I don't begin to get inside anybody's head but my own, and I just, I know that, you know, we haven't spoken in a long time, you know, and to be honest with you, I'm so busy. I'm not looking for new friends. I'm just looking for people who want to work together on different things. And I don't want to say I can work with anybody, but I can pretty much work with almost anybody on the planet if you're sincere and that you're not trying to just push off issues. You don't have some other agenda, because that's where I'll get some pushback from people that I don't play well with others. And I always tell them, I go, that's true, because I'm impatient.
The pushback I hear is usually coming from the
correctional officers. Yeah.
Correctional officers. So there are people who send out stuff under assumed names as if, hey, guys, that's what I do for 30 years. I know who you are. Okay? I know that your name's not Patricia. Okay? Sending me the scoop of the day on Tom Dart. But I don't see that stuff getting traction. What is the issue with Teamsters?
You know, I continue to try to work with them. We haven't had a good relationship. I'd be lying to you if I said, oh, well, it's been great. No, it hasn't. I have, I think, 18 or 19 different unions in the sheriff's office, and I'd say to you that other than the Teamsters, I have a pretty good relationship with all of them. But I think there's an inherent part that no matter what union, you know, I'm the administration, they're pushing, they're all that. I understand that. And so there's some inherent tension. But I'll be honest with you. I think that one of the bigger ones is that I've been adamant about people have to show up for work, because I never thought that was going to be an issue when I signed up. I thought I was going to have all these other issues. But the notion that I have to spend so much time and energy on getting people to show up for work is mind-numbing.
Example was a story recently, July 3rd. Like,
Father's
is this,
Day.
What?
The day after Father's Day, that was the...
Yeah.
Right,
that was the big one.
Yeah, yeah. I think we had 200 or so people calling sick, or it was about a third of the people that were supposed to show up for work called in sick. And
so that means if, like, on 4th of July or on 3rd of July or 5th of July, I should not get arrested and being taken to county jail because there's no guards to protect me.
Well, we might put the suit on you.
Right.
We might put you out there.
There you go.
Yeah, and I've tried to explain. We truly have. I mean, could we do better? We can always do better. But have we tried to make it a better environment? Yes, we have. Have we been pushing all sorts of cameras and everything else to try to make sure the safety and security is at a higher level? All, yes, we have. Can we do better? Yes, we can. But at the end of the day, you signed up for this job. I didn't force you to take this job. And yes, you get medical time. And I often tell people, listen, if at the end of the year you have extra medical time, what you should do then, I would suggest to you, is you should go to your church. You should sit there in a pew and thank God that you were healthy all year and you have your health. You shouldn't look at it as a bonus saying, listen, I've got these medical days I haven't used. Time to use them. Because I, as a boss, can't predict that then. How can I predict that you're going to call in an hour before your shift and say, I'm not going to come into work? Now, all of a sudden, I got to do one of two things. I've got to either take the good people who showed up and say, listen, I know you plan on going home to your family to that first communion. You know, you can't. We're requiring you to stay here because we need someone to watch this tier. Or I have to pay overtime, which is very expensive. And so
You can't do the first because of contract.
No, I can. We call it mandating, and we've had to do that, John. And we feel horrible doing it. We don't do it that often, but we have had to do it. And we feel horrible doing it because basically you're penalizing the good people, but we have to have someone to watch people.
Here's another problem I see that you have, and that is, and it's not your, it would be any sheriff. Who are you guarding? Who are you having these? You don't have the PK?
Yeah.
A lot of them, a lot of the problems are, but not all.
Correct.
You have jerks and people who are brutes and thugs and barbarians, right? And if I were a guard and somebody slugged me or spit on me or feces on me,
yeah,
you know what my reaction would be?
I know.
I'd take the club and I'd beat the hell out of them.
And John, that's
not that I could because I'm a fat old guy now, but you know what I mean? That's what I would want to do.
And see, John, that's
is
why...
Is that wrong of me? Am I insensitive?
That's why when we put up these videos just last week, which showed the officers being attacked, they weren't cherry-picked. We put the ones up where it was, unfortunately, the reality of what a lot of these officers faced. What did it show? It showed some of that happening to them. And then what did was the other part? It showed the professionalism, where they said, this guy just threw something at me, and did I take hit him? No. I stepped back, went and got other correctional officers.
And then we hit him.
No. We put him in cuffs.
That's
we
what
took
I
him, and we got him out of there, and we took away his phone calls. We took away this, that, and the other thing. But you're 100% right. I always make the point. It's like, yeah, the jail has a mixture of people in there. Do we have a load of mentally ill? Yeah, we have about a third of the population is diagnosed serious mental illness. Do we have a lot of people in there on minor crimes that really shouldn't be there? Yeah. But then do we have about 20%, 30% of the population that are violent, bad people? Yes.
And like those Latin Kings I saw that killed a kid in Warrenville.
Yeah.
You have.
And those people need to be kept away from society, in my opinion, forever. Right. Forever. And so, but the thing is, we have to have clarity that with the limited money we have in law enforcement and criminal justice, the money needs to be devoted to them, to keep them away from society. We can't keep wasting money on mentally ill dumped into the most expensive setting that we could imagine for them. And then it's not designed to fix them either, by the way. And people that are in on warrants for traffic. They had a suspended license. They didn't take care of it. There's a warrant for the arrest. Now they're sitting in my jail. We're wasting all that time and money. We should be able to shrink the jail to just these violent, bad people, give our guys more and more tools to deal with them, and then have that just the way station onto prison for the rest of their life.
$150 a day?
That's if people don't do anything. That's if they just sit in their cell and don't cause any problems.
Can't we make that cheaper? Like, what do you feed them? I would give them bologna sandwiches.
We give them bologna sandwiches.
That's it, right? That's what I would do. Beans, bologna sandwiches, a tent.
No.
Sheriff Joe Arpaio style. Come on, Sheriff Joe.
He gets his fair share of lawsuits as well as I do. But the thing is,
you're not like you don't come off like that.
No, I'm sorry. You know, I've often told people like that. You know, to me, you have to treat all human beings with respect, and in doing that too, it minimizes the lawsuits. It minimizes the amount of money the taxpayers are going to get stuck paying with. Want to send a statement? You know, I'm going to dress everyone in pink or whatever it is. And for the most part, the vast majority of the people in the jail are getting out. And what people don't understand, they think everybody in the jail is on their way to prison. 85% of the people that are in the jail go right back to the community. So if we don't try to fix them, we aren't thoughtful in what we do, what are we doing? We're infesting that community. More cancers. We're making it worse. There's going to be more people streaming in. So I've looked at it as like, we got to break this. We got to break this. And we're not going to do it with any perfection. It's not going to be a sure thing. But boy, oh boy, let's give it a try. And let's just not sit there and say, let's throw everyone in a cell, leave them there, spit them out into the community that doesn't have any resources to start with. And then let's all look amazed that they came right back in.
I agree. And I would have to ask you another question on another subject, which is you have children.
Yes.
And so
five.
Do I. And now you, your dad thing, you come home and do your dad.
And I'm also a baseball coach, too.
Baseball coach.
And not a good one either, by the way.
That's good. And I hope you get some of the kids in the neighborhood, the kid umpires. Have they ever thrown you out of the game?
Like, no, I haven't.
Come
had
on,
it.
Take a walk, mister.
No, that was
a strike. All right. So I have to ask you, when you have children, you want to go to museums. All right. That's what we do. Sometimes, right? We go to a museum. Think of this this idea. Museum on the lake.
Well, you know, it definitely caused some dissension in the house because my son's a huge Star Wars fan, and he and I watched every episode I don't know how many times. He was obviously very excited in his backyard, sort of. I want the museum too, but I just, you know, I don't have all the books and numbers and all the rest of this stuff. But just as an operating idea, I've always felt that beautiful things. I was at yesterday, dropped my son off for soccer and was driving down Lakeshore Drive on the way to the office. And I was just marveling at how gorgeous our lakefront is. It really is. I mean, if you see it, it is a marvel.
Look at Cleveland.
It's an absolute marvel that there aren't these long piers sticking out. There's boats there. There's all these horrible warehouses. And all that. It's just this marvel. So anything that would break that up has to be really well thought through. And the notion that someone who obviously has quite a bit of money couldn't figure out a way that we can off the lakefront a little bit, not a lot. I'm not saying launch it out to the western suburbs, but no.
Thank you.
Take it and move it maybe a half a mile, a mile, 2 miles into an area that probably doesn't have much going for it as it is right now. It would immediately transform that area. The lakefront doesn't need transformation. It's gorgeous right now. So I was just sort of puzzled by the fact that if we were going to do this thing, and it could be such a marvelous thing, we find an area that was maybe a little bit better. And I once again, I don't understand
it all. It just speaks to the tone deafness mayor of Chicago is smarter than that. A smart politician wouldn't do that. So I just,
and I don't,
unless it's about him moving on, thinking I take care of these rich people and all the and the Hollywood, Melody Hobson, John over there at the Capitol and all these people, and I'm just going to move.
You
That's
know,
what it made me think.
Well, the one thing I was thinking is that they were obviously privy to a lot of conversations that certainly me and not yourself privy to, where maybe that was like the beginning. That was like the third rail thing. That the only way the commitment was going to be is if it was there. And I would just say that I would have just lobbied from the beginning saying, listen, we cannot thank you enough for being so kind and want to bring this to our city. It was phenomenal. But please, we really need to look at a couple different options here that are going to be something there. Bring you all sorts of everything you want. But it's just not going to have to be in this one location. And I just don't understand the intransience of that because
here's what worries me.
That's what my dad said too.
Right. But I think that you give a promise to listeners of Chicago that if you're ever mayor, that you will follow the old time mayor example, not the new time mayor. Never go on bended. The mayor of Chicago never goes on bended knee to some rich guy, even if your best friend asks you to do it.
Yeah.
No?
I don't think there'll be any fear of me doing that. No, right. I don't think I'd get in the door to even bend down because I'd have my Mount Carmel sweatshirt on.
Tom Dart, sheriff of Cook County, thinking about becoming mayor someday, maybe, has his family and his job to do as sheriff. Thanks for being in with us.
Thanks so much. This was really fun.
The Chicago Way, Tom Dart, John Cass, Jeff Carlin, and we'll see you